to cook it, not.
Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, October 1st, 2025. And today we're going to talk with Larry Wilkerson. He's going to be here with us just in a minute. I'm
going to burn that dude up like a Brazilian Chaco.
How's it going, Larry?
Been a hectic day. Hectic day.
Yeah.
So many people asking questions about Quantico.
Yeah. We had some sort of technical problems before coming up. That's why we're late. Sorry for that.
No, it was me. I didn't even try to come up till 10 minutes late.
Larry, let's start. We talk about the meeting that Pentagon has managed, and they're trying to talk with colonels, with generals and admirals.
The one at Quantico, the one I was just talking about. That's what everybody wants to talk about.
Yeah. It was, but after all, Larry, looking at what has happened, it was so bizarre, the performance of Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump. What was that? I can understand Pete Hegseth because he was working as, you know, as a reporter, as a journalist at Fox News. He feels the same way. Don't see that he feels that he's the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense of the right now, the Secretary of War of the United States. But it was so strange. He was trying to say something to the people, to the audience, his audience. What was the message, in your opinion?
It was absolutely bizarre. I can't describe it any other way. And as bizarre, but welcome in my military professional mind, was the stoic response of his audience. I mean, they were truly imbued with what I would say is an ethic that is pure in the United States military, probably more so than any other military in the world. I don't say that loosely. And that is that they had talked to the old boys, Milley, and others like Milley, Paul Eaton, for example. And this is a very important thing with general officers and admirals. You listen to the old boys because the old boys have been there. They have done that. Their experience is rich. And they came in with the idea of, we're just going to sit here. We're not going to have any facial expressions of note. We're not going to clap in any particular way. We're not going to acknowledge anything that's being said as we're pro or we're con, and we're just going to sit here. It really was a spectacular performance in a subdued sort of way by 300 or so of these generals and admirals. And it was probably the only performance they could make other than getting up en masse and walking out in resignation. And I had that argument with the general just a few minutes ago before we came on and right after I finished the judge, because he had sent me an email reprimanding them for not getting up and walking out. And I said back to him, general officer, I said back to him, what would happen to the real security of the United States if they were to do that? Because you'd be talking about abandoning all of the key positions in the U.S. military in front of all our enemies on television. And you that would be unconscionable to do that. There's too much. Right now, we're looking at a potential war. I think it's coming. It's coming like a freight train with Iran. That has the potential to go nuclear. And we're looking at the Europeans being so stupid, they just keep playing with Russia to the point where Russia might take some really drastic action. And we wind up with two theaters that have the potential for nuclear war. And we're going to have the entire U.S. military leadership walk out in protest and resign. I mean, that's preposterous, really. I would have faulted them for doing that. That's preposterous. You've left your country naked. So it was a bizarre situation. And the Trump presidency and the clown show that it is, and Hegseth's sycophancy within that clown show, and his lieutenant, he doesn't rise any higher than a lieutenant, language on the stage didn't compensate for that at all. You have a three-ring circus going on. Trump is the major clown in the center. Hegseth is the clown in the ring on the left. And Rubio is the clown on the right trying to foment a war with Venezuela. It's a clown show, but it's a very dangerous clown show. And I give it to the military leadership for recognizing that and not responding in any way to deepen and make more profound this crisis.
Here is what a part is very, again, bizarre part of Pete Hegseth, what he said.
F-A-F-O. If necessary, our troops can translate that for you.
A little bit of laughter. A little bit of laughter out in the audience. Probably coming from Hegseth's plants. It's just, he talked like an E6. An E6 in Special Forces. A staff sergeant in Special Forces. That's what he talked like. A staff sergeant in Special Forces who in Afghanistan, for example, was probably brought up on charges for using inordinate force, disobeying the rules of engagement, which he was suggesting should be done from his position on the stage. That's what he is. He's no better than a staff sergeant. He's no better than, I'm not demeaning staff sergeants or non-commissioned officers in general. I'm just comparing Hegseth's brain with the brain of someone who is a potential war criminal on the spot every minute of his service and whom you have to watch carefully to restrain him from being a war criminal. That's kind of what Hegseth presented the image of. And sadly, Nima, sadly, that has become the special forces, the special operating forces, Rangers, SEALs, the special teams that we have for drug fighting and everything. That's become the culture of that group of people. There's a book right now out, and there's going to be a Quincy Institute event with the guy who wrote the book. I recommend it to everybody today that they tune in, because this guy is going to tell you about what we have done to the special operating forces in the U.S. military. We've corrupted them. We've let them get away with murder. Trump has even pardoned some of them who got away with murder and were indicted and convicted. And then he pardoned them. And Hegseth would do the same thing, saying that they were prohibited from doing their duty, that for your country, you can murder, you can torture, you can do anything you want to do. That's the ethic of the special operating forces in the United States military today, or at least too many of them than it should be. And that's what Hegseth was encouraging. That's what he was talking about. And he's one of them. He's one of them. That's the only war, that's the only uniform time he knows. And even that wasn't very significant.
Who's he trying to intimidate? He's talking about the enemies.
He's trying to get them to get up and walk out. Yeah, he's trying to get them to get up and walk out. That was the impetus there. Go leave. They didn't think a lot of them would leave, of course, but a few of them would have been a good example for them to make. And I understand there was one or two that actually got up and said, I'm out of here. I'm gone. And now they're talking about non-disclosure agreements. They're talking about polygraphs. They're talking about all manner of way of checking the fidelity of these officers who sat there and were stoic and didn't really respond to Trump or Hegseth. I mean, the response to Trump was absolutely the most bizarre but understandable response I've ever seen to a commander-in-chief. And Trump violated everything the commander-in-chief is supposed to stand for, and Hegseth did explicitly. There's a, I'm sorry, DOD, okay, DOD regulation. It's called 1344.10. And it prescribes the behavior of uniformed personnel in a sort of pseudo or a genuine political circumstance. And it's explicit of what you can and can't do. Well, look what you had. You had the commander-in-chief up there creating a political aura for these guys in front of him. And you had the Secretary of Defense doing the same thing. essentially saying in the words that were uttered there, both of them, Trump sort of incoherently, but Hegseth pretty coherently, we're going to go into the cities and we're going to clean them up. And we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And we're going to do this and we're going to do that. This is not the military's duty. This is a violation of everything the Constitution was put together for. It's a violation of posse comitatus. It's a violation of every practice, every ethic the military has tried to imbue in its ranks, especially its flag officers. Not that it hadn't been violated on occasion, but usually the person violating it is punished rather rigorously. This is unconscionable, what the president and the secretary. We have a phrase, Donald Rumsfeld did away with it, but it is very indicative. It's the phrase National Command Authorities, NCA. My whole career, I lived under that phrase. What Rumsfeld did was say there's only one National Command Authority, and it's the Commander-in-Chief. So he did away with the phrase because NCA meant the Secretary of Defense and the president. Rumsfeld's point was it's only the president. So they did away with it. But it was a good phrase because what you have is two civilians in the chain of command. The president who gives the ultimate order and the Secretary of Defense who ensures it's carried out. Both are civilians for a reason, because our founders would never have tolerated uniformed people in those positions. Now, if you're retired, we have made exceptions. We've made waivers and so forth, starting with General Marshall after World War II. But even that is a testimony to the fact that we don't like uniformed people in those positions. And of course, a president is normally not a military officer, or if he is, he's long gone from it. Eisenhower might have been the most recent one who really was, you know, a military officer of some consequence, a five-star general, but it was, he even had the good sense to go be the president of Columbia University and do some other things before he ran for president. You do not want this national command authority to be corrupted by entering the military field. That's what Hegseth did. And that's what Trump tried to do. Of course, nobody would put Trump would have absolutely impossible for Trump to enter the military field because he's fat, he's out of shape, he's old, he's stupid. He'd never get in there. But Hegseth, you know, he's standing up there, macho guy, look at my tattoos, everything else. And he's talking as if he is one of the troops, one of the lower troops, one of the special operating forces troops who's left the regime of the Geneva Conventions and the rule of war and the law of land warfare and everything else that pertains. And he's talking the way he would talk as a lieutenant or a sergeant in the special operating forces with nothing to do but kill people and relishing the fact that he has nothing to do but kill people. That's the National Command Authority talking to these generals in that way. That's unconscionable, and I'm sure they thought it was. And this idea that Patton or Stockdale, Admiral Stockdale, you remember the comment he made about if they were out there, they would be, you know, up in arms that we've done what we've done to our woke military and everything else. Admiral Stockdale would have stood up after the third or fourth sentence Hegseth uttered and walked out on him. No question. This is the man who was Ross Perot's vice presidential candidate well after he left the military, who taught ethics at the Naval War College, who was a superb, if you will, Stoic. He followed the Stoic philosophy. This is a man who would have said, as he did, what am I doing here? Remember, I don't know if you remember, you're too young, but he was in the debates as the vice presidential candidate. And after a couple of questions that were just stupid as hell, he just looked at the moderator and he said, what am I doing here? Why am I here? And he left. That was Stockdale. And Patton would have got up on the stage and slapped Hegseth silly. And the other general was Schwarzkopf. It was an insult to Patton, Schwarzkopf, and Stockdale, a total insult to say what they said. So he doesn't even know his history, and he doesn't even know his military leaders, nor does Trump. Trump doesn't do history. He's not. He doesn't do history. What Trump said about the scientists and climate change, that they were perpetrating a hoax and therefore they were evil, he thinks about his history and historians too. They're perpetrating an evil too. They're evil. Well, the evil person is Trump, not the historians, not the climate scientists. The evil person is Trump. The person perpetrating a hoax is Trump, not the scientists.
Larry, they're moving aerial tankers from Europe, from the United States to Europe, then from Europe to Qatar, and the same.
Just like they did before the last attack.
Yeah. What is that? Do you think? Are we gonna? How close are we to the war between the two?
Bibi, you probably know this. Bibi went back to Israel, and after telling Donald Trump that everything was copacetic with the ceasefire deal and the ultimate end of the war in Gaza, went back in Hebrew and told everybody, no such thing. The war's going on. The IDF's going to kill them all. We're going to finish the war. So that duplicitous lying sack of proverbial horse turd is doing it again. Why? Because he knows what's coming. He knows what's coming. He's not going to have to talk to Donald Trump. He's not going to have to apologize. He's not going to have to get out on bended knee. He wouldn't anyway. He kept his coalition together, which he probably wouldn't have done had he come back and said what he said to Trump about agreeing. And he knows he's going to war with Iran. And he knows the United States is going to follow him. That's going to obviate. That's going to cancel everything he said or promised to Trump. So he doesn't care. We are going to war, Nima. We're going to war with Iran again.
What would be the benefit of the new war? What is the main objective, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, and overriding everything else, is preservation of Bibi Netanyahu's coalition and Bibi Netanyahu, period. His power and his position. That's the first objective. The second objective is to keep the United States from causing him to have to do something he doesn't want to do with respect to Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere, I fear. I'm hearing from contacts in Baghdad, for example, that they're getting ready to go to war as well. I'm hearing that Egypt might be on the warpath also. I'm hearing that remnants of the forces in Lebanon, which mostly are Hezbollah, are ready to go. I'm hearing there are elements elsewhere in the region that might enter the fray with air power. Think Saudi Arabia, think Qatar, for example. So, and I'm also hearing, and this is very disturbing, and I don't know exactly how to take it, but I'm hearing from people who met with Berzekian, the president, and met with other Iranians in New York, not only that they have changed the fatwa from one that bans nuclear weapons to one that bans the use of nuclear weapons, which sort of clears the way for them to go ahead and build one if they haven't already. And I'm also hearing that they're not going to just attack Israel. They're going to attack other assets in the region. And that's the way it was put to me. And I asked the question, do you mean Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait? What? No, I mean U.S. facilities in those countries. So they're going to attack the U.S. outright. Yes. Is that meant to be a deterrent? Is it meant to be a bluff? I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they've had it, if they're fed up with this. And if Israel does commence the war again in a serious way, that it's all over for Israel. Plus, they will do the damage that they can to the United States facilities in the region. And they could do a lot of damage, a hell of a lot of damage. That they could sink an aircraft carrier if it were in range of one of their high-velocity missiles or a spread of those missiles is, I would say, 60 to 70% a possibility. And then we're off to the races, Nima. I mean, we're off to a regional war. One wonders what Russia and China will do if this starts in that flagrant, overwhelming way. What will they do?
So what's this story of peace plan? What is he trying to get by the peace plan? Is that some sort of cover for what they're doing?
The one Bibi allegedly signed up to? Well, I think that's ultimately Tony Blair. That's essentially Tony Blair running some sort of consortium that will make Gaza, you know, into the thing Trump wants to make it into, a huge enterprise that will make money and so forth and so on. And maybe it has a patina of a potential for a dual state eventually in order to satisfy the members of the Abraham's Accord and get them back into it. I don't think it's going to work. And I know it's not going to work with what Bibi went back and said in Hebrew, which was, I didn't mean any of that. We are going to continue this war. We're going to continue it until Hamas is exterminated. The hostages be damned. He didn't say that, but that's essentially what was implied. And I know I'm safe, at least for the interim, because I'm going to war with Iran and the United States will have no choice but to come in with me.
Larry, maybe I'm so much pessimist about what Donald Trump is doing, but it seems to me that Donald Trump has came out by this sort of plan. He has come out by this plan because of Netanyahu's position in Israel. Because those people who are forcing, putting a lot of pressure on Netanyahu and his administration about the hostages.
Right.
And they're trying to tell those people, so we are trying to do everything. Look at Donald Trump. He put out a peace plan. They're not going to sign for it.
No.
We have to continue the conflict. You know, they're somehow legitimizing what Netanyahu is doing in...
I think Netanyahu wrote the hostages off a long time ago. I really do. I don't think he gives a damn about them. And he doesn't give a damn about them because he feels like they're an impediment to his finishing the job, as it were.
Yeah. After all, Larry, if something... Now, you've mentioned Iran would attack the U.S. bases in the Middle East, but isn't that somehow strange? That do you think that Turkey knows what's going on? Do they really care about what's going on in the Middle East? What is the role of Turkey?
Turkey is a NATO member, the staunch anchor of the southern flank of NATO, which is not saying much today because NATO is falling apart. I think Erdogan, given his previous performance and all this debacle that's happening around him, would just sit there and watch. I don't think he's going to. Now, were Israel to start to topple, seriously topple, fall into chaos, Jews going everywhere, I mean, that's what you're going to have. I found out the other day, Nima, that over 1.5 million Jews have already left Israel. 1.5 million. With all the strictures that Netanyahu has put on travel, still 1.5 million have had enough money or enough connection to get out. In that event, if it were completely collapsing and it weren't nuclear, Erdogan might move. But that's the only way that guy will move.
When it comes to the defense treaty between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, is it going to...
Good question. Ask it.
How is that going to play out?
Very good question, because I think that's probably signed in blood. And it's probably signed in blood, not necessarily with the civilian leadership, but with the ISI and the Pakistani military. And in particular, with that portion of both that more or less looks over nuclear weapons. And that means that Saudi Arabia has a nuclear weapon at its beck and call whenever it wants to use it. You know, I'm of a firm belief that when Mohammed bin Salman first became defense minister and took the portfolio, one of the things he did was go to Islamabad and spend about $20 billion of Saudi money, $20 billion U.S. I think that was a contract with Islamabad with regard to, at that time, Iran possibly developing a nuclear weapon, Islamabad said to him, you will have 20. I don't know what the number is, but 20 is sort of military. Yeah, I'd want about 20. So 20 weapons will come your way instantly when Iran tests, or you know Iran has a nuclear weapon. That's the agreement. Now it's been put in blood. I mean, you know, it is a defense pact now. I don't know if that's a portion of it, but I do know that my contacts tell me that it includes, if it's nuclear, we'll be with you. We'll be on your side. So we've got a whole new ball game, and it's not just Iran and Pakistan. It's also the fact that China is a supporter of Pakistan, but it's also a fact that China is really got vested interest in that Southern Railroad that comes up through Iran now. And it's also the fact that you have a rapprochement between these previous enemies, Iran and Riyadh and others in that complex. What does that mean in terms of what might happen to U.S. facilities in the region were Iran to feel like it had to attack them because it was first attacked by Israel and the United States? Would the Saudis even care about U.S. facilities being attacked as long as Iran only attacked them? No oil facilities involved, just U.S. facilities. We've already seen what happens when Qatar gets attacked by Israel. Would they just sit there if it were only U.S. facilities that were attacked? I mean, you could attack Al-Udeid and just attack the aircraft on the surface. You wouldn't have to do that much damage to the airfield. You could just wipe out the U.S. aircraft on the surface. And a surprise attack would pretty much do that. And it would be, I think it would be a surprise. I think this is not something that we would be expected by U.S. Central Command. So, you know, two can play at this game of surprise. Two can play at this game of duplicity. And it's about time that Persians used a little bit on the Arabs and on Israel. And I suspect that maybe the IRGC and the national military and maybe even the Guardian Council and the Majlis in particular, it's been pretty vituperative. It's been pretty warlike. Okay, we're in for a penny, in for a pound. We're going to take these bastards on. I wouldn't blame them a bit. I mean, the history is just too ripe with their being finally angry enough to do something to the great Satan.
Larry,
you're Iranian. How do you feel about it?
Yeah. 2 days ago, Larry, there was an interview with the head of the Security Council of the parliament in Iran, the former head of the Security Council. He's a long-term politician. He's a high-ranked politician. He knows everything about the defense. And he said that, I don't understand why the government in Iran is so shy about talking about their capabilities, the military capabilities of Iran. I know that Iran has the power to bring any sort of war to Armageddon. They're so powerful. They know, because I know what's going on, considering the capabilities of Iranian army.
Right.
Why they're so shy to talk about it before happening. You know, it's so, you know, I look at it, it's so dangerous. Everything, in each and every way I see it, it's the conflict. It's so dangerous if they go to a full-out war against Iran.
Nima, if I were in charge of the military power of Iran right now, and this is no, I'm not Persian, I can't crawl into their heads, but if I were as a military professional in charge, I would unleash my entire capability minus what I thought I needed in case the United States did come in a big way, because I don't think they need all that to take care of Israel, and I would devastate Israel. I'd do it in. I'd just completely do it in. And I think it could happen in 48 hours. And then I would just announce, you want to fight the United States? I've got a lot left, but I don't want to fight you. When Israel was burning and falling apart and collapsing, and God forbid that they should use a nuclear weapon in that scenario, but that's a different ballgame altogether. Then I would say to the United States, let's stop. We've gotten rid of the people we wanted to get rid of. You can go in and help them fix themselves, but I don't think you're going to be very fortunate in that regard because we really destroyed them. If you want to fight further, we will, but we'd prefer not to. That's how I'd do it. I'd wipe Israel out, just wipe them out. And then, 48 hours, 96 hours is all it would take, maybe even less than that. And then after that fait accompli is visible to the United States, put it out there. We don't want to fight you. We don't want to fight you, but we will if we have to.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it simultaneously. I know it would be more effective and more surprise, tactical and operational surprise, if they hit everything at once. But it would also detract from their ability to just wipe Israel out, because they'd have to devote some of their forces to the other targets. And it wouldn't give them any leverage against the United States. They would have considerable leverage if Israel were a smoking ruin, fait accompli, and they said to the United States, we don't want to have a fight with you. We've taken care of the enemy. The enemy was running rampant. It was killing Palestinians at a rate that was unfathomable. It was performing genocide. We did what the International Court should have done. We did what the UN should have done. We did indeed what you should have done for you. Now, we don't want to fight with you over it. So let's stop. I mean, that's what I would do.
I believe that those, all of those Arab states would be more than happy if that happens from top to bottom. They're so afraid of talking, but you can feel it, how the population, the public opinion feel about Israel.
Yeah. It's happening in this country too, especially amongst those under 40. That's what got Charlie Kirk in trouble, because he recognized that from his vantage point, all the things he was doing that built up MAGA, that built up the young people in particular, that put the young people in Israel's camp and so forth. He realized all of that was taking steam out of his major movement because there were so many young people questioning why this was happening with regard to Israel. And he tried in that long letter, which I read twice this morning, he tried in that long letter to tell Netanyahu in very, very guarded language, but you can see it in there. You can feel it in there, where he's telling him, you're losing these people. Therefore, you are losing the future. Well, that's happening across the board with Democratic youth, and it's happening to a certain extent with MAGA youth and Republican and conservative youth. And that's what Charlie was saying. And I think that's what got him killed. But they're not paying any attention to it. They're just doubling down. They're hiring more companies, building more public affairs campaigns, trying to capture more. Look at Larry Ellison and these jerks who are with him, Horowitz and the others, who are trying to get TikTok, trying to make sure that this slippage doesn't continue, that they get the high ground again for Israel. I think they've lost. And the young people are the ones they're losing, and that's the future.
Now, unfortunately, for the case of Ukraine, we are back to a square one.
Yes.
And, you know, Keith Kellogg said that Russia has no chance of winning the war. Here is what he said, Larry.
Not overpower NATO. He cannot overpower the West. He just can't. He does not have the capacity to do it. I have talked to senior leaders in Washington, D.C., and I've been asked that very question. Can Russia win this war? I said, no, they can't. They do not have the capability to win the war after 3 years, those losses.
Who are these senior leaders that are giving him this information?
I'll tell you what. It's the same kind of thing that's going on with Venezuela right now. Venezuela has an Ahmad Chalabi working for it. not for Venezuela, but for the 5% in Venezuela. And all the intelligence that is coming to Trump, he won't take the intelligence from the CIA, the DIA, the INR, or any of the vested intelligence entities, let alone Tulsi Gabbard. He won't take it. And the CIA director is just a sycophant. He's taking his intelligence through people like Miller and Laura Loomer, and he's getting it from two people. Rodil, who's an Israeli, operating with the Venezuelan opposition, if you will, the Juan Guaido types, and Gary Burnson, who was a CIA agent, got kicked out of Afghanistan when he messed up with Tora Bora, and is now operating a private firm and taking millions and millions of dollars from this group in Venezuela and manufacturing the intelligence against Maduro and about Trinagua and passing it to Trump. Does this remind you of anything, Nima? Does this remind you of Curveball and Colin Powell at the United Nations in February of 2003? I mean, this is what's happening with Venezuela. We're manufacturing the intelligence with a very small group of people who have a vested moneyed interest in that intelligence, and they're passing it on to the president through non-professional intelligence people, and the president believes it. The same thing is happening with people like Kellogg and Petraeus and others with regard to Ukraine. It's false intelligence on Russia and its capacity, and it's sustaining the war, winning the war. And it's also passing on bogus intelligence about everything from casualties to measures of destruction. It's crazy what's happening, Nima. You got two theaters of war that are being lied about to a president of the United States who doesn't like the professional intelligence people because they don't tell him what he wants to hear. Kellogg tells him what he wants to hear. And this guy, Rodil and Burnson, tell the president through Laura Loomer and Steve Miller and others what he wants to hear. And so that's what we're doing in terms of strategic policy. We are actually acting on people whose interests are not vested in the United States, but are vested in their own income, their own reputation, their own ability to interpret the battlefield, like Kellogg and so forth. Kellogg should go away. He should go away, but he won't, because he says to Trump what Trump wants to hear, as do these other people. This is George Bush writ large in terms of intelligence. I mean, Cheney was manufacturing it out of whole cloth and giving it to the president as evidence of Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction. The CIA was forced by Cheney to do the same thing. Powell was forced by Cheney to go up to the UN and give the presentation. All of this was manufactured, Nima. The same thing's happening with regard to Venezuela, and the same thing's happening with regard to Ukraine. Here's my great fear. It's also happening with regard to these people being extrajudicially killed on the high seas. Now, the one cigarette boat, that probably was a boat pushing drugs. I don't doubt that. I saw the surveillance tapes from the Coast Guard airplane that was trailing it for so long. I think that probably was drugs. But still, you don't blow it out of the water without any due process whatsoever, unless you're Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth. Violation of international law, violation of the Geneva Conventions. It's just like if I saw you on a street corner on New York Avenue in New York City selling cocaine, Nima, and a line of 1,000 people down New York Avenue buying your cocaine, and I'm a policeman or I'm a militia member in Washington, D.C. I walk up to you, you're selling cocaine. I take my rifle and I blow you away. Any more around here so I can blow them away too? No due process, no arrest, no awareness of his rights, no court proceedings, no trial, just blow him away. It's the same thing. It's just out on the ocean. That's what we're doing now.
Larry, the case of Europe is getting so strange, specifically when it comes to the United Kingdom. I don't know if you've heard Ben Wallace, the former UK defense secretary, talking about Crimea and how he's seen Crimea and what can they do to Crimea.
I think what we have to remember is what motivates Putin. Putin is in love with the idea of dominating Ukraine, taking Ukraine. Crimea is Russia and Russia is Crimea, he announced in 2014. If you read his speeches of 2014, he compares Crimea to the Holy Mount. So we have to help Ukraine have the long-range capabilities to make Crimea unviable. We need to choke the life out of Crimea. And I think if we do that, I think Putin will realize he's got something to lose. If it is not inhabitable or not possible for it to function and that bridge, we need Taurus in from Germany. We need to smash the cursed bridge because that's an ego, that's a statue to Putin's ego. And I think if we do that, Putin will suddenly realize he's got something to lose.
And then there will be an Arestnik missile or two or three or four or 20 or 60 coming in with nuclear warheads. This guy is insane. He's utterly insane. He doesn't recognize that Russia is a competitive power on the world stage with China, with India, certainly with America. It is a superpower in a multipolar superpower world, if you will. I don't like the term superpower, but it is one of the peer powers in a multipolar world, a multinodal world, as Ambassador Freeman likes to call it. It's not Britain, in other words, Mr. Former Dude. It's not Britain. It's not some pipsqueak sitting on an island living in the shadow of the American empire. You stupid man. You're going to get people killed. You're going to get a world war started. You're going to get a nuclear exchange, and you don't give a damn. Your words right there told me you don't give a damn. You're as bad as Kellogg. And I'm sick and tired of England. I got to tell you, I've been an Anglophile for years and years and years. I love London. I love Wales. I love Scotland. I love Ireland. I love, you know, England. But I am sick and tired of that pipsqueak government in London. And apparently, from the massive demonstrations that have been happening, so are the English people.
The problem with Europe is that the people cannot do anything.
You're right. You're right. And there, and no place other than England has been leading the pack in doing that, suppressing their people. I mean, guy told me the other day, you don't dare breathe on a street in London, you'll be arrested. I can't believe that. I went to London for 25 years with my wife before she died. Every year, every Christmas, spent New Year's there. I don't recognize it anymore. Keir Starmer's London is draconian, absolutely draconian. And King Charles ought to be ashamed of himself, but he should be ashamed of himself way back there. Princess Di would be, she'd be falling over herself trying to condemn the people in England now.
We had the problem with this attitude of name calling Russian president or the Chinese leader and Chinese president. And right now, Donald Trump is calling them the whole country as a paper tiger.
Yeah,
Russia
right.
2 times.
11 times. Eleven time zones of paper tiger, defense industrial base that's cooking out more artillery rounds in a month than we can make in a year, cooking out hypervelocity missiles at a rate that's about 12 or 15 times as fast as we can make them, could do tanks, could do any other instrument of war 5-6 times faster than we could do it. Economy is cooking on all cylinders. Look at the stats from 2025 that are in right now. Oil has dropped in terms of its contribution to the Russian economy, whereas other things have come up in terms of their contribution. These people are smoking some really low-grade stuff, Nima. They need to go get a new drug dealer.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carl.
Sorry to get so carried away, but I tell you, these people really make me angry. I'm at the end of my life, and I'm dealing with idiots.
Yeah, it's so.
And as I told the judge today, they're going to come after us. They're going to come after all the truth tellers. Did you watch Edward Snowden's interview? Incredible. I'm getting emails from military people and others saying, I never knew this guy was that smart. I never knew what he really stood for. Why is he in Russia? This guy knows what's happening. Yeah, right. He does. He knows what's happening. He predicted what was going to happen in spades. And now he's even more eloquent than he was when I heard him at William & Mary, you know, video teleconference from Moscow. And he's a hero. He's a hero amongst a crowd of people I never thought he would be a hero amongst. He's a patriot. And he's telling the truth.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It is. It is that you come to this point in your life and you're looking at your country just falling apart around you. And we're headed for a civil war in this country. We're headed for a civil war. You listen to Governor Pritzker give his talk. I mean, you know, you don't want to go into the South Side with that militia. There's 20 guns per individual in the South Side of Chicago.
It seems that each and every solution in the mind of Donald Trump is a military solution. Yeah. He doesn't care about anything.
And he never served a day in his life. Never served a day in his life. Bone spurs. At least George W. Bush was in the Texas National Guard. He hardly ever went to any meetings, but he was in the Texas National Guard. And if you ask his dad, why was he in the Texas National Guard? Well, we wanted to keep him out of Vietnam. No.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you, Nima.
See you on Friday.
Keep doing what you're doing, but watch your flanks too. They'll come after you in Brazil.
Yeah, we have Lula here. Let's see if Bolsonaro can win.
27 years, is that what he's in there for?
It's not going to get that. Yeah.
Good. It couldn't have happened to a better individual. Take care.
See you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.